I'd like to bring a message of solidarity from the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty in Toronto to this meeting, but more importantly to everyone here in this city who is facing harassment and intimidation because of standing up and fighting for what is just and what is fair in this city and beyond. I would say that those people who find themselves targeted by the forces of the state can take satisfaction from the fact that they are part of a very long and proud history of resistance that we can all say that we stand on the shoulders of. On June 15th, 2000, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty organised a march for homeless people and allies on the Ontario Legislature, and we faced criminal charges as a result. Here, it was a challenge to the G7. And if we're talking about the criminalisation of dissent, the first thing that must occur to us when we look at those kinds of examples is that we live in an insane world where people who go out and challenge injustice are the ones who must defend themselves from the charge of being criminals. When we marched on the legislature back in Toronto, we were aware that so far that year, 22 people had died, homeless people had died on the streets of Toronto. And when it comes to the crimes of the G7, even the officially known ones would fill volumes. That which we don't know would probably fill volumes more. And to say that anybody who stands up and takes a stand against such acts of theft and murder and violence and fights back against them must defend themselves from a charge of being criminal is astounding and insane, and we should keep that in mind in what we talk about. I think if we're looking at the state and legal attacks that are coming down on people today, we're looking at the kind of charges that are being laid and the kind of court proceedings that people are having to drag themselves through. It's important to look at some of the backdrops to that. And the first and most important one, and it plays out everywhere throughout the world, the common thread is, I believe, what is sometimes described as the neoliberal agenda. In other words, the whole decision that has been made in the corporate boardrooms and correspondingly in the legislatures and parliaments to completely change the rules of the game, to take back all barriers that stand in the way of the enrichment of the few at the expense of the many, and to remove all previous social entitlement, all regulations that limited the banditry of multinational corporations. That is that agenda that is unfolding, and as it unfolds, and as populations start to feel a sense of grievance and start to resist those changes, whether it be fishers in PEI, whether it be people across the world, whether it be people in any Canadian city, when people stand up against that agenda, increasingly the response of the state is to say that we are not going to make concessions. We are not going to provide social provision. We are not going to provide health care and social programs. Our solution to your grievance is going to be literally the policeman's billy club and the jail cells and the courts. And that is the backdrop to this whole situation. And the second aspect to it that I think is enormously important, that is a common experience for all of us, is that we are facing in our own movements and in our own populations, a crisis of effective resistance, a crisis of opposition. And we grapple with it in various ways, but it is an enormous problem. We went through a long period in history, especially in the historically privileged parts of the world. We went through a long period in history after the Second World War when concessions were being made, when living standards were improving, when social programs were being introduced, when the succeeding generation had a realistic expectation that they were going to do better than their parents had done in terms of their living standards and their future. And that has come to an end. That period of tactical concession, sometimes referred to as the post-war settlement, has come to an end, and it's been replaced by its complete opposite, an agenda of taking everything back. And you see, during that period of relative social compromise, the reality was that social resistance became more constrained, more limited, less explosive, more ready to settle for compromise, because concessions were being provided. But the difficulty we have today is that the other side has unilaterally revoked the deal. But many on our side, unfortunately, are still playing by the rules of that dead deal, of that exhausted compromise. And so we, in our own lives, have to grapple with the question of how we can, as we like to say in OCAP, fight to win. And that question of how we deal with resisting, of how we take up an effective resistance, is an absolutely decisive one. At an earlier period in history, people didn't believe that the notion of resistance was raising a futile moral protest in the hope that the governments were listening, because the governments of those days certainly weren't listening. They weren't interested in moral protest. In order to win things, you had to actually build a movement, a social movement, that was strong enough and powerful enough to actually achieve things. That's how the trade unions were built. That's how people were able in the 1930s to organize for their survival in the face of the Great Depression. You know, in 1929, when a delegation of the unemployed was allowed to meet with the Prime Minister of the day, R.B. Bennett, it was suggested to him that the government should introduce unemployment insurance for unemployed people, which at that time made up a huge chunk of the population. And Bennett's response was, "Never will I, or any government I'm part of, put a premium on idleness." And yet, in 1935, Bennett tabled a bill for the introduction of unemployment insurance, just before he was voted out of office. And you have to believe that it wasn't that Bennett went around the country and saw the suffering of the people and his heart melted and he had a change of heart and he decided to become kind. It was that the unemployed in those days organized such a powerful and ubiquitous resistance that created such a political crisis for the governing authorities of the day that social concessions were forced out of them. And if we look at the example of how the trade unions were built in this country, it's an even more powerful example. You know, there were explosive struggles that were engaged in order to win the right to unionize and in order to achieve these things. And today, I think what is happening is that perhaps belatedly, perhaps inevitably belatedly, but what is starting to happen is that people are beginning to realize that we cannot go on playing by the rules of a dead deal. We cannot go along resisting on the basis of hoping that those in the parliament buildings are listening to us because we make a compelling moral argument. During the days of the protest movement against Mike Harris, I was always enormously irritated when I heard people make the comment, "Mike Harris, I hope you're listening." Believe me, Mike Harris was not listening. But he could have been made to listen. But to do that, you had to speak his language. It's no good speaking to him in the language of reason and moderation and compassion. You have to speak a language that he's going to understand. And so, throughout the world today, you're starting to see, and Aaron made the point quite correctly, that it's in the historically oppressed countries, sometimes referred to as the South, where you see the most compelling examples. But you see people organizing to fight back in a way that really makes a difference. A couple of weeks ago in Toronto, we were enormously pleased that João Pedro Stagile, the one of the leading figures of the landless peasant movement in Brazil came to Toronto and gave a talk on the struggles of his organization. In countries like that, you're seeing people organize resistance that isn't based on the possibility of a good soundbite on the 6 o'clock news or putting forward an argument that'll be compelling and interesting to the people in power, but people are actually organizing to take what they need and to make a difference in their lives. And we, I think, need to start looking at those kinds of examples ourselves. OCAP has tried, in its own way, a small poor people's organization based largely in the city of Toronto, but we've tried to begin to put into effect the same kind of notion that it is today absolutely imperative if we are going to organize an effective resistance to proceed on the basis of fighting to win. And I'm going to talk more on another occasion about some of the work that we've done, but I just wanted to give a small sort of flavor of some of the kind of ways in which we've tried to organize. We live in a very large city where there is an enormous amount of homelessness, where there is an enormous amount of poverty, and where each and every day there are rampant injustices going on. People are denied welfare, people face deportation from the country, people are being evicted from their housing. Some 2,000 people a month are being evicted from their housing in Toronto at the moment. And we tried to organize on a case-by-case basis to fight back against those things. So we've organized something that we refer to as direct action casework. It doesn't usually mean going to the tribunals and speaking to adjudicators. It means bringing 50 people to a welfare office to ensure that a family gets the check that they're entitled to. It may involve going to Pearson Airport to try to prevent a deportation from happening. We've done that successfully on a couple of occasions. It may involve, as it did on one occasion, a situation where we went to a Shell gas station that was refusing to pay wages owed to an employee that it had laid off, and putting up a picket line to prevent them pumping any gas for a couple of hours, which had an enormous impact in terms of creating social conscience on the part of the employer. Those kinds of actions we organize all the time, intervene in hundreds and hundreds of situations. And we've used the same kind of techniques in order to address bigger questions. We've organized several squats, and a couple of them have been successful in terms of winning housing. We've organized takeovers of facilities that were threatened with closure, that were drop-ins and shelters for homeless people. We've organized those kinds of actions, and the one action that seemed to have managed to offend the powers that be perhaps more than any other was the event on June 15th, which is where I want to bring back some of the experiences we've had around precisely the criminalization of dissent. On June 15th, 2000, we brought about 1,500 people to the Ontario Legislature. A great percentage of the crowd was made up of homeless people. And we didn't want to do precisely what most people do when they go to Queen's Park, which is make 78 speeches and then leave. We wanted to do something that would be more challenging to the government, something that could actually have the potential to force them to show a mark of respect to people who really were what you might describe as despised collateral damage, homeless people. We therefore went to the legislature with a simple demand that a delegation of people affected by homelessness be allowed to address the legislature. Now, we're not, I confess, experienced parliamentarians, and we were told that, in the words of the Speaker's executive assistant, it would be outside of the Westminster model of Parliament for such a thing to occur. We knew that Hilary Weston, the Lieutenant Governor, gets to yammer on in front of the legislature all the time, and we knew that visiting dignitaries get to do it. So it seemed to us entirely reasonable that homeless people should be allowed to speak to the people who were in many ways the direct architects of their misery and actually put that forward. But we also anticipated it was likely that they would take a different view. So we were aware that we would be blocked, and we were ready to go there with the demand, to press the demand, and hope that ultimately we might broker a deal, that we might be given the opportunity to meet with the Premier, to meet with senior cabinet ministers, whatever. But they chose a course that we were astounded by. They moved to clear the grounds of the legislature. So what they did was they rode horses into the crowd, and they began what the riot police refer to in their technical terminology as punch-outs, which is full-speed baton charges into the crowd. And when the head of the riot squad was asked in court, "I take it, sir, that your officers are trained to hit with these large clubs as hard as is necessary," he said, "No, they are trained to hit as hard as they possibly can." So when this happened, they anticipated, I imagine, that there would be a rout, that people would flee the grounds. And what actually happened is that there was a battle, is that people stood their ground and people fought back. It wasn't organized, it wasn't planned that there would be a confrontation, but once they began the confrontation, there is no question that the people we brought to Queen's Park did not turn their back. There was a major battle on the grounds of Queen's Park, and it took them an hour to clear the grounds away. Now, at the end of this, they began a process of demonization and criminalization. The event was portrayed in the major media as the most evil thing that had ever occurred in the history of the planet. And I'm only very slightly exaggerating. They as well went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada to win the right to all the media tapes and photographs of the day. They ended up arresting 45 people and charging them, some of them with quite serious crimes. Some of the homeless people were arrested, and I think about half of the people arrested, between a third and a half of the people arrested that day were homeless people. They had the hardest time of all getting out of jail. One young homeless man, James Semple, spent 7 months in the Don jail before he could make bail. I was there and picked him up. As I was saying earlier tonight, I was there and picked him up when he got out of jail, and the first thing he said, it was worth it. So there was a huge drive to attack us. Now, what they also did was they imposed absolutely rigid bail conditions. Everybody that was arrested was given a bail condition that they could not associate with any other member of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. So that was 45 people who were faced with the kind of banning order that you would associate with the apartheid regime in South Africa. There was also serious repercussions when anybody might get arrested on a minor charge afterwards. So that I was arrested at a political protest sometime afterwards, and because of the bail conditions I had, it took me a month to get out of jail. That was an experience that several people had. But what they also did was that they singled out three of us, Gaetan Eru, Stefan Palipa, and myself, and they charged us as so-called organizers of a planned riot. And they laid two charges. Against Gaetan and Stefan, they laid the charge of participating in a riot, which carries a 2-year jail term. And to participate in a riot, it is only necessary that you are one of three or more persons gathered together for a common purpose in an unlawful assembly that has begun to disturb the peace tumultuously. I mean, that could be Jerry Springer. That could be just about anything. It certainly could be any picket line skirmish. It certainly could be any demonstration where any level of disturbance occurs. And against me, they laid the charge of two charges: counselling to participate in a riot and counselling to assault police, based on a speech I made just before we went up to the legislature. Now, to lay a charge of that kind against somebody who makes a speech has implications that are so obvious I don't need to spell them out, but a conviction on that would have been incredibly serious. And in fact, it wasn't any minor charge. The two charges together were potentially 7 years in jail. So that went ahead, and they moved towards a jury trial. Now, I would like to just step back and say that the laying of those kinds of charges in the post-war period has been very, very rare. And to lay them against, lay them as part of an orchestrated attempt to crush an organization is almost unprecedented in the post-war period. You would have to go back to, perhaps the charges that were laid against the leadership of the Communist Party in 1931. Where they laid Section 98 criminal code charges and seditious libel charges against them, and gave seven members of the Communist Party, I think a total of 40 something years in jail, and you would have to go back to the kind of charges that were laid of conspiracy and riot against unemployed workers in Newfoundland in 1935, and. In terms of the counselling, when they sought to bring in legal precedents to put before the judge, they themselves had to keep coming back to the 1930s. That was where all the precedents. That's where all the precedents lay. Laying of charges against someone for making a political speech, we couldn't find any direct comparisons. The closest we could find in two examples we could find in Canadian history were Annie Buller, who got 18 months hard labour in 1931 for a speech that she never actually made because she wasn't there at Estevan in 1931. And the other one would be a Nova Scotia example in the 1920s, J.B. McLaughlin, who in protesting against a brutal attack on striking steelworkers by police, wrote a letter deploring this to his own union members and urging them to take solidarity action in support of the striking steelworkers. And he was sentenced to 2 years in Dorchester Penitentiary for seditious libel. And the prosecutor argued that it didn't matter whether what he said about the police was true or untrue. The very fact that he was trying to create disaffection by saying it made him guilty, and a jury right here in Halifax convicted him in the 1920s of that charge. So those are the kinds of examples that we were really sort of looking at and basing ourselves upon. Now, the whole point is that when they go that kind of a route, they have to make a real go of it. They have to lay on all the trappings. So we had the right to a jury, and we had the right to, as they like to say, full answer and defense. And we decided to utilize that right to the maximum. We went with a jury. We didn't go with judge only. And we put forward a defense that was, to us, very, very important. We knew we were looking at serious criminal charges, but we also knew we were engaged in a really vital struggle. And we didn't want to engage in some set of wretched, cringing apologetics. We didn't want to go into that courtroom and put forward a defense that would shame the movement that we were part of. Even if we ended up going to jail, we were determined to put forward an effective but a principled defense. And I really believe we did. So much so that I remember when I'd finished my testimony, the prosecutor, when the jury left the room, suggested to the judge that I had made a de facto admission of guilt with my testimony. And but it didn't quite work out the way they wanted. We put forward this basic theory of the defense, that we were a militant poor people's organization, we were an anti-capitalist organization, that we were engaged in a struggle against an inhuman system and an inhuman government, and we were working for the defeat of that government. That we came to Queen's Park on June 15th, 2000 to demand that a delegation of the homeless be heard, that we were prepared to organize a militant standoff with the police, that we were prepared, if necessary, to pull away a section of the barricades that they had erected in order to facilitate that standoff. But we also argued, quite truthfully, that the confrontation that occurred in the way that it did occurred because, first of all, with incompetence or deliberate provocation, they hadn't erected the barricades properly and they immediately collapsed en masse. And secondly, they engaged in a insane drive to clear the grounds of the legislature, despite the fact that after some initial interaction, there was a palpable, undeniable lull in the situation. They organized this punitive attack that precipitated what became known as the Queen's Park Riot. And we put that forward, and we put it forward very, very clearly and without any hesitation. And at the end of the day, to their amazement, what happened was that the jury became deadlocked. Now, it didn't actually amaze us, because we sort of thought a jury tends to be drawn from more conservative sectors of society, and certainly it's operating in a climate where it's in you know, not exactly in a worker-friendly environment, as you might say. But nonetheless, we calculated that a jury would probably reflect some of the political differences that exist in the province of Ontario, and it did. And so the jury became deadlocked, and the Crown had assumed that 20 police witnesses, hours and hours of videotape, pictures of people wearing bandanas and the accused making militant speeches would guarantee a conviction, and they were wrong. The jury became deadlocked, and at the end of the day, the judge had to declare a mistrial. And they then made a pathetic attempt to try to go it again. They decided to stay the charges against Gaytan and Stefan and put me on trial before a jury a second time on the same charges. And what happened was, is we put forward an argument, what's called an 11B motion. We put forward a constitutional argument that I had not been given trial within a reasonable period of time. And that was won. And my charges were stayed, and it never went to the jury the second time. And then the Attorney General intervened to ensure that the Crown would not appeal, and the whole thing died. Now, as I say, what to us was enormously important about all this is that we wanted more than anything to be able to put forward a defence that counted for something, and I believe that we did. And I believe that at the end of the day, we can say that you don't have to go into court and get down on your knees and beg and say you're terribly sorry and you know, you really do live in a wonderfully fair society and I don't know what went wrong, but it'll never happen again. You don't have to do those things. But on the other hand, you don't just have to say, I defy you and your filthy system, take me away and lock me up and I'll love every minute of it. It is possible to put forward a defence that actually counts for something. It's possible to put forward a defence that can actually win you some things. And so the that's the most important lesson that we draw from the whole June 15th trial experience. Now, what has also happened, however, in the wake of June 15th, is that we have experienced on an ongoing basis the most insane levels of police mobilisation against our demonstrations. There are a lot of cops in Toronto, as you can imagine, and they're not very nice people by and large. But there aren't enough cops in Toronto to police OCAP demonstrations anymore. Because when we organise a demonstration, they bring in police from Barrie, from Hamilton, from the OPP, from the RCMP. They bring in actually police reinforcements from other police forces to bolster their numbers. And they're all kitted out in riot gear, and the horses are there, and they have tear gas launchers and plastic bullets. And so the mobilizing that we've done after June 15th for a whole extended period had to be conducted in the face of that. And so we've also had to learn some important tactical lessons about how to deal with the fact that Chris said that they're stronger than us. We're actually stronger than them in the sense that there are a lot more of us than them, but of course they have state power and they're more organized at the moment. And you know, we're working for the day when that changes. But at the moment, the point is well taken that they have a capacity to deal with us that we can't we can't just ignore. We have to find ways to deal with them. And so some of the things that we've tried to put into effect is a form of mobilizing that still works to achieve our objectives and still takes a militant and disruptive direction, but at the same time neutralizes in one way or another their capacity for violence. And that's been important. So that 1 year and a bit after June 15th, we organized the march, and it was mentioned earlier, the march into the city's financial district. And we organized this, about 2,500 people, to march into the Bay Street area of Toronto, the financial heart of the place, the belly of the beast, as they like to say. And we organized this march that would be deliberately aimed to have a major impact, a march by a poor people's organization into the largest financial center in the country. Now, what we did, however, is we knew that the police mobilization would be insane. They used 7 different police forces. They had, I don't know how many there, but there was a 4-figure crowd of cops. And they had plastic bullets ready to go and all the rest of it. So what we did was we used the tactic of the snake march. We used the tactic of not actually having a specific place that we were bound for, but marching in different directions and making up as we went along, all with the purpose of getting into the financial district. And it was an incredibly effective tactic. Since then, the police have learned to respond to it, and the point is well taken. You can't just endlessly replicate your tactics. But used on that occasion in that way, it was enormously effective. It threw them into an absolute quandary. And in fact, people that were arrested that day were listening to the police radios and got a sense of just how perplexed they were by the whole thing. Like, at one point, they decided we were going to the stock exchange. So they moved a whole pile of cops down to the stock exchange. Then they decided we weren't, so they pulled them away. Then they decided we were again, so they pulled them back. And then they had a conversation in which they said, they're not coming to the stock exchange, but we can't leave again because somebody in the media is going to get an idea we don't know what we're doing, so we're going to have to stay there. So, and we were told by 2 paramedics who were standing close to Chief Julian Fantino that at one point he slammed down the phone receiver and said, there is nothing we can do to stop this. So, and to me, the highlight of the whole thing was the deputy chief of police, Boyd, doing this interview with City TV, saying there is absolutely no way that these people are going to get to the corner of Bay and Adelaide. And at that moment, City TV's cameras go to this crowd of 2,000 people standing at Bay and Adelaide. So that was an effective technique. And there have been a couple of other similar examples where we've used the same, not exactly the same technique, but used the same approach of trying to find a way to get around them. You may remember a couple of summers ago, the Pope came to Toronto. Now, we thought that the papal visit might well be an occasion when even Julian Fantino would be a bit embarrassed about clubbing homeless people on the head. And so we organized a takeover of an empty building, and we called it the Pope Squat. And we got enormously wide support from whole sections of the community, including many Catholic people who came out and supported it. And our calculation was correct. It was the lowest kind of police mobilization we'd seen for a very, very long time. And the place actually held for 3.5 months before they finally found a legal pretext to evict, although it is now going to be opened up as a rooming house. At least it won't remain a totally empty property. And then during the summer, we organized a huge feast for the homeless in Yorkville. Now, people who don't know Toronto, Yorkville is the most upscale restaurant and boutique district you could imagine. On a Saturday night, it's astounding who goes to Yorkville and what money there is to spend. And we did a little bit of research, and we were doing it just before the election was going to happen. Now, the Conservative government in Ontario had introduced, as many people will know, a massive cut to social assistance. And at the same time, it had implemented lavish tax breaks for the wealthiest in society. And we did a little bit of research, and we discovered that a corporate CEO making $1 million a year, of which there are a few, would be receiving from the government the same amount of money that had been taken from 17 single-parent families on welfare. So we essentially went to Yorkville that night to target that whole sick transfer of wealth. But we organized a feast. We didn't want to organize some, you know, street theater soupy gruel to give to homeless people. We really did want to organize a feast. So we appealed to people in the community to cook and to do a huge, huge feast up. And the high point of the thing was that the people from the Mohawk community, Tiandanega, which is down near Belleville, brought up 600 servings of venison. And there was, we were able to put on the most incredible, there were picnic table after picnic table full of every kind of dessert, every kind of, it was just a fantastic feast. And we put it on right in this park in the middle of Yorkville, where they have these elaborate fountains, and they have a big rock that they brought down from Northern Ontario, a huge dome-shaped rock, as a sort of a conversation piece, I suppose. We fill that rock and beyond with homeless people. The participation from the communities to the south where homeless people live was enormous. We put on buses and it was incredible. And we created the political conditions where we were merely asking for the right to assemble and to march to, and the right to march through Yorkville. And they couldn't really find much of a pretext to prevent it. And so we were able to organize that event right at in the pre-election period. And similarly and lastly, last month, we organized another takeover of an empty building were able to win that when the reigning member of parliament for the area intervened and offered to resign his job as a member of parliament if he couldn't succeed in getting the building turned into social housing within a month. We actually discovered in the last couple of weeks that was successful and that the building will be opened up. So I think we're just about ready to wrap up what I'm saying here, but I'd just like to conclude by saying that I think the most important lesson when it comes to this whole question of the criminalization of poverty is that our right to resist must be regarded as non-negotiable. Our right to organize resistance is something that cannot be stopped. And it is imperative when we face these situations of criminal charges, and sometimes they appear very serious and sometimes they are very serious, but it's enormously important that we not be diverted from what we're doing. Like over the years when OCAP was facing a situation where dozens of people were going through the courts and where some of us were looking at very serious jail time, we never stopped organizing. We never stopped our fight. We never became a de facto legal defense organization. We continued to be a poor people's organization engaged in a struggle. And what's linked to that is that it is vital not to be intimidated. We actually won for the most part around the June 15th trials, and that's very good. But if every single one of us had been sent down, I can say we wouldn't have been intimidated, we wouldn't have been stopped, we would have carried on organizing. And at the end of the day, we came out of it stronger, wiser, and with a much more diverse and wide set of activists organizing in OCAP. And in large measure, we owe that to the prosecutors and the cops who provided us with that enforced training regimen. And so I think that we're now dealing with a situation where there is this inhuman agenda that is being imposed on communities, and it's reflected in 1,000 different ways. It's reflected in the privatization that's happening to the people in the townships in South Africa. It's reflected in what's going on on the streets of Toronto, on the streets of Halifax. It's an agenda that has to be resisted and has to be stopped. And I believe in the course of building that struggle, when they come against us, if we organize effectively, politically and legally, we can come out of those battles stronger than we went into them. We have to learn, I think, to share our experiences to share the victories we have and to share the setbacks as well, and to learn lessons from them. But I believe that we are on the road to building a movement of resistance that really is going to fight to win and even ultimately transform this society. Thank you very much.